Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about the food policy issues that shape our everyday experiences of growing, buying, and eating food. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network, and I am your host, Kim Kessler, with the Resnick Program for Food Law and Policy at UCLA's School of Law. This week, the focus is on the climate crisis and its connections to food, and I want to begin the show today with a few reflections on the climate march that took place on Sunday. Joining me here in the studio to talk about this is Ralph Logiski. He's with the Food Environment Reporting Network. And on the phone, we have Nadia Johnson, the director of the Food Justice Program at the New York City-based organization Just Food. Hello to you both, and thanks for joining again on Heritage Radio Network.
Great to be here.
Nadia. Same here. Thank you.
So I was at the march on Sunday. You guys were both at the march on Sunday. And obviously, it's been a really huge week here in New York City with the UN Climate Summit and the major march leading up to that. And for the first time, I think, I want to talk about the role of food groups and their presence at the march. I saw them as a significant presence. And it was really a turning point of sorts in terms of that. So, Nadia, can you talk about Just Food's role in the event and why you were there and how you helped to organize around it?
Sure, yeah. Well, we were one of, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of people who were part of the food justice convergence of the climate march. We knew when the march was announced that there was interest amongst some food justice groups. Largely the Brooklyn Food Coalition played a huge role in coordinating us as a group, but a lot of groups sort of got involved in that process to see if we could, you know, march together as a block to really show the food dimensions of this issue, both in terms of climate mitigation and adaptation, from Just Food's perspective, you know, one of the solutions to the climate crisis is really building and strengthening local food systems. A lot of our food travels around the world in order to get here. There's a lot of CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions from industrial agriculture, from factories all the way down to, you know, deforestation for, like, massive meat production, et cetera. So there are a lot of aspects of this issue in terms of how food and agriculture are contributing to the climate crisis, and also how the climate crisis is contributing already to a lack of access to food in certain communities around the world, and certainly that can grow if the climate crisis continues. So that's why we were involved in the march.
And Ralph, you have been involved in working on food system issues for a really long time, and I want to hear your perspective on, you know, what you saw leading up to the march and the role that food groups were playing.
I think it's interesting. I received a lot of emails from a lot of advocacy groups, you know, really from months in advance, telling us to be a part of history. And so I came as a journalist, so working with the Food Environment Reporting Network, I kind of wanted to see what it was all about. But I used to work with advocacy groups such as Meatless Monday, and we would look at the impacts of livestock and how much greenhouse gases they would represent. And there are studies that came out from the UN that it says that livestock represents about up to 14 to 18% of all greenhouse gases that we as humans contribute to. So I definitely know a lot about the issues. I did find it interesting that it wasn't people who were at this march weren't all coming from the same place. I think we talked about there was labor there, indigenous people. I walked in the group with all the food people, which is interesting. So I kind of saw a lot of my folks. But I think it was really fascinating just to see how everyone is recognizing that everything's interconnected. And I don't think that's an issue or a way that people have been thinking about the environment. I think even the climate march people even pointed this out, that the idea of labor and environmentalists working together, oftentimes they're not seeing eye to eye, and the fact that they all marched together was really kind of neat. So we had a lot of labor groups out there, a lot of unions.
Right. And it's similar in a way just to food policy issues in and of themselves, the interconnectedness and the challenges around that, around organizing and telling the story, because the issues can sometimes be so complex. And Nadia, you used the word convergence, or I think it was the food justice convergence. So can you talk about, I guess, you know, what did that represent? Where did the term convergence come from, if you know, and who was participating?
Who was represented in it? Like a lot of organizing, the name evolved over time in the organizing process.
Name is often one of the harder points.
Evolved into food justice convergence, and I think that just the climate situation definitely impacts all through our food chain, from the production side of things all the way through processing, distribution, food we have access to, food waste, all of those areas. It's a labor issue, it's a farming issue, it's an access, food access issue. So I think that's where our food justice convergence title came, because we're bringing together all of these different sectors of our food system who are all impacted in the same and distinct ways from the climate crisis, and have similar messages in terms of the solutions to it. So that's where that came from. And in terms of, just food, we work with communities around the city to,
it sounds
support
like you're...
markets for local foods through CSAs and community-run farmers markets and farm-to-food pantry, and do a lot of work supporting urban growers through our farm school, NYC, and we're really able to do a lot of outreach to those communities, and I think a lot of people turned out for the march from those communities. But it was really exciting to see the breadth of the food justice movement there at the march. The only thing I regret is that I didn't get to see the other aspects of the march, because it all sounded so, it was all so cool. There were groups of families, meeting, and there were bikers, and there were, people who were advocating for clean energy, and there was so much happening, people from different boroughs and different cities and states around the country converging together. So The only thing I regret is that I wasn't able to see all of it.
Get around more.
Amazing to march.
Nadia, we're having a little bit of trouble with your connection. It sounds like you might be somewhere fun, or maybe you're moving around a little bit. But I want to turn to Ralph, and maybe you could just try to be in a different spot when we come back to you next. But I wanted to get both of your perspectives on one other aspect of this, as people who have been involved in the food movement for a really long time. How has this changed? I mean, where were we if this had happened? Well, this discussion obviously has been happening, but a major march in New York City, is it something that you would have seen yourselves being a part of in a really significant way, or the groups that you've worked with being a part of, if this was 10 years ago, 5 years ago? How has it changed?
I don't think 5 years ago we would have seen the food people involved. I think it's really fascinating. The message has come out. I mean, people like Michael Pollan, they're the movie Food Inc. I mean, they're all bringing the idea, the concept that everything is connected into a system. And I think we're realizing that food production impacts the climate, it impacts water, it impacts health, personal health, animal health, all these different things, that it just touches everything. We're realizing that we need to be a part of all the big things that are out there. And I think it was just kind of a sign of solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
But I did one thing, and I was just thinking about it. And it's funny that when we talked earlier, we kind of preparing for this discussion, the one group that I didn't see, which I wish I had, was farmers. I wish I had seen more farmers. And oftentimes we talk about the convergence, or I don't see, and this is my critique of the food movement, I think that oftentimes we're not always talking with the farmers or giving them a voice, because they certainly don't want people to think that agriculture in itself alone is to blame for all of these problems. You know, that we're all working together. There's so many different people. There's so many different, you know, groups. And I think we talked about industrial, and we really want to make sure that people understand that it's industrial agriculure that is leading to many of these problems, not necessarily just agriculture within itself. And I think we need to make sure farmers are painted in a way that show that they're not the culprits for all of this.
No, and I think a lot of the discussion is also that farmers are on the front lines of contending with this and are most at risk, which of course means that all of us are at extreme risk because we rely on farmers. But Nadia, do you have any reflections on that? Did you see any farmers, maybe some urban farmers at the event? And then also, can you just tell us a little bit about just personally how it felt to be there?
Yeah, okay, so I'm sitting, I moved my position and I'm sitting super still, so hopefully you can
yes,
hear me okay.
Yes, it's great, it's better.
Well, yeah, I think there are so many, there's the New York City Community Garden Coalition there was Just Food Farm School NYC, staff and students and teachers, people who are part of different growing projects around the city, so there's a huge urban ag community there. I think also it's challenging for the farmers to actually get away from the farm this time of year. The high harvest farm. But we and others definitely did a lot of outreach to farmers. So we're up to get them there. I don't know how many were able to come. There was also an attempt to get a tractor to be part of the food justice convergence. But that proved to be a permitting challenge. But yeah, I think, and also, you know, in terms of 5-10 years ago, you know, this climate change issue has been around for, I think scientists identified it as a potential growing challenge at least 20, 30 years ago. So when I started at Just Food about 6 years ago, we actually started working on a food prints campaign with a bunch of other groups around the city, you know, recognizing the connection to our food system through climate change mitigation and adaptation. And so we did a lot of work around that with then council member de Blasio. We also in 2009 hosted a summit with the then borough president of Manhattan, Scott Stringer, the New York City Food and Climate Summit. And so some of the stuff that, you know, started about 5 years ago have really evolved into extensive policies by the city, from the mayor's Plan YC, now includes some food and agriculture targets, the city council food works, et cetera. So
right,
we've seen a real growth there.
Right,
We
had opportunity to work on together, going back to when I was in the mayor's office. And with your conference, I remember that, and we actually later, our guest on the show later, which will be Joan Gussow, who spoke at that conference, and I know is on your board as well. So some of the early thinking and building blocks that helped create the network that was able to be present at the march on Sunday. And Ralph, just hear from you, any final thoughts on, you know, what it was like to be there, just the feeling of the day?
I was glad I was a part of history. I think, you know, the idea that President Obama did kind of allude to the march when he was speaking to the UN.
Yeah, pretty clearly, I think.
I think so. I think it made an impact. I think it definitely let people know that this is a big issue, that people believe climate change is an issue, and I think that's something that a lot of Americans, I think majority of them will say that the science is pretty much there. and I think showing that big showing showed to the world that climate change is a big issue, and we're not necessarily pushing it as a policy issue as much as we would like to see. But I think I just felt that it was important and good to see.
So we'll leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for being on, and we'll take a short break and be back in a little bit.
Thank you.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
We're thrilled to announce a special event, the Silver Snail, 25 Years of Slow Food. This event is hosted by Slow Food USA, Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's Pizza. It's been 25 years since Carlo Petrini and a group of activists launched a peaceful revolution to defend regional traditions, good food, gastronomic pleasure, and the slow pace of life. The slow food movement has since evolved into a comprehensive approach to food that recognizes strong connections between plate, planet, people, politics, and culture. Today, this movement involves thousands of projects and millions of people in more than 160 countries worldwide. Join us for a dialogue between Slow Food's founder, Carlo Petrini, and locavore activist, Alice Waters, as they reflect on the evolution of the food movement and all things slow. Friday, October 3rd from 11:30 to 2:30. You can go to our website and click on the link on the right-hand side of the page to RSVP. We can't wait to see you there.
We are students at Girls Prep, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. I am honored to introduce Joan Gussow to the program. I can't think of a more fitting guest for our climate crisis show today. Joan has been called the matriarch of the Eat Locally, Think Globally movement by the New York Times, and she's the former chair of the Nutrition Education Program at Teachers College at Columbia University, where she still teaches the course that she first developed, Nutrition Ecology. She's the author of several books and an extended list of articles, and her thinking and teaching has influenced many of the major leaders working on food system reform today. And Joan has done all of this while tending to a garden and growing most of the food that she eats. So, Joan, welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm very glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Kim. Actually, we have, from my viewpoint here, we have a really terrible connection. I hope it's going out better.
I can
just barely hear what's going on at your end.
I'm getting the all clear from our engineer. So hopefully you can hear me a little bit better now. Does that work for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope the listeners can hear better than I can hear.
Yes, we can hear you. We can hear you perfectly, which is obviously very important to what we want to accomplish today. So I want to start out with one of the things in preparing for today's interview. One of the things that I came across was a quote of Michael Pollan in an Edible magazine story about you, where he said that once in a while he thinks that he has an original thought, and then he realizes that you said it first. And given that, I have to ask you, what was it that got you thinking about food and its connections to the environment going back to the start of your work in the 1970s?
Well, really, I was concerned about world hunger to start with. And when I went into the field of nutrition, I went in because I was also concerned about the food supply and the, sort of the things I saw in the supermarkets that had appeared there since I had last went to the supermarket just before I went off to college in California, and then 12 years later came back, moved out of New York, lived in the suburbs, and went back to a supermarket. I was simply appalled by what had happened. So I went into nutrition thinking everyone would be concerned about these things, and it turned out nobody was. So I had come really from an environmental background. My husband was a vice president of Friends of the Earth, and I was very concerned about all these issues, and so I began just collecting stuff that interested me. And as I collected it, I would, at the end of each year, school year, I would, in the summer, I would collect things on my dining room table and ask myself, what on earth has had to do with food? And so I just gradually put together a series of topics that seemed to me to be related to food. Agriculture to start with, which no one was looking at, but all the environmental consequences of the kind of agriculture that we were at that time pursuing, pesticides, herbicides, all the fallout from that. And it just evolved into this course, which I taught, and then somebody came to me and asked me to do a book from my course, and I did that, and it's called The Feeding Web. And that's what Michael was referring to when he said what he said, because it's true that when I look back now at The Feeding Web, which was published in 1978, it's stunningly relevant, which suggests that little has been done to deal with the problems.
Right. I think that is something in reading some of the articles that you'd written as well in preparing for this. You know, a lot of the topics are incredibly resonant today, and to your point, indicating that, you know, these issues are, if anything, much more significant than they were then. But when you mentioned keying into this because of the items that you saw in the supermarket, can you elaborate on that? What was it that you were seeing on supermarket shelves that made you think?
Well, when I was born, there were 800 items on the supermarket shelves. That was 1928, and it went up to about 1,000. And then came the post-war period. What happened was, during the war, there wasn't a lot of new products introduced. And then the post-war period came, and one of the places where they saw there was a possibility for growth, we'd been feeding all these people overseas and all our troops overseas, and the food industry was concerned about continuing to grow. And so they invented all these, and they had developed all this machinery for preserving products to get it shipped overseas, so all these techniques. And so they started inventing products. And so what I saw when I went back to the supermarket, which was in the 1958, I guess, was this appalling collection of stuff. I remember writing that I saw women feeding their toddlers donut holes, baby donuts, and juice drink, and I was just stunned. Of course, it's much worse now, but I thought that was just an appalling choice. And my kids ate cheese. I opened the thing of cheese when I walked through the supermarket, and they gnawed on a piece of cheese. But the truth is that we have developed so many products. They're not, I don't even call them products. They're food odd. They're sort of food items. That are food-like items, really. I mean, that are in the supermarket. That we don't really need any of these things,
right? And just the idea that the number of items in and of itself represents a certain amount of processing.
That's like 30,000 to 40,000 items now,
right?
Which is ridiculous.
It's so
just ridiculous.
The course is, I know, about the connection between food and how we grow food and human health, but you shared your syllabus with me, and I noticed on there that there's also a class that's dedicated to information pollution and the question of what can education do. And I, you know, we live in a world today where there's so much information, and a lot of it is paid for and sponsored content. I read recently in a news article that there's now more than 4 PR people for every journalist. But I wanted to get your take on, you know, what does that have to do with food? And what do you tell your students about what education can do about the issue of information pollution?
I first put that topic in about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Maybe more, time does pass. But because I wanted them to understand that there was a lot of information coming from the food industry that was designed to be misleading. But about 3 years ago, it occurred to me that things had gone way beyond that. It had nothing to do anymore with just the food industry trying to put out publications like the dairy industry. But it was like the web had multiplied the opportunities for this so that it was incredibly hard to figure out what the truth was. Whenever something came out that was controversial, not so much controversial, but in any way attacking or threatening the powers that be, the people with the money, then the response that came out was so bludgeoning, so overwhelming, that it was very hard to keep hold of whether was it true what you knew or was it not true what you knew. And so I tell my students that the best thing you can do is to have some kind of cognitive frame, which is what my course is intended to create. It's intended to tell you where to put each little piece of information that comes in. Otherwise, you just end up with a heap of stuff that doesn't mean anything. So the course tries to create a kind of cognitive frame around food. Oh, I see. This reason air pollution is important is because of this, or, you know, that's what it's about. And the other thing is to look at who's promoting it.
Right, and sorry to interrupt you, Joan. But you were talking about the response that you can get sometimes when you go out with a new idea or with an idea that's critical of the status quo.
Right.
And I know that that's something that you've experienced in particular with one of your proposals that I want to talk about a little bit more today, which is one of the potential policy levers for changing the American diet to be more climate friendly, more climate resilient, more overall sustainable, which is the dietary guidelines for Americans.
And I was fascinated to learn from the piece that you kindly sent me about the latest report on it that the majority of the comments that have come in about putting sustainability into the dietary guidelines are from the food industry.
Yeah, so I want to... I want to just back up a little bit for listeners who aren't familiar with that. And the piece is a Civil Eats piece that was summarizing some of the feedback that's come in already. But the dietary guidelines, you know, are set basically the pattern for how the government is going to advise Americans to eat healthier. And this is where they were first introduced in 1980. They're updated every 5 years. And this is where, for people who aren't familiar, we get My Plate and prior to that, the food pyramid. And for the first time, the committee, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, has requested comments on the concept of sustainability and has sustainability as one of the topics for one of their subcommittees. And this is a recommendation that you first made, I think, in the 1980s, that this is something that should be a concept that should be incorporated into the dietary guidelines.
Right.
But going back to the initial conversation, received a lot of pushback to it then. So I'm interested in your observations about what the potential implications are of changing the guidelines to incorporate ideas of sustainability, and you know your recollections from that time or the evolution of the discussion since the time that you first brought this up.
Well, I think there's a great big elephant in the room, which is called beef. Obviously, the guidelines have traditionally, because of the force of everything, been very modest about you know being sure to have lean beef and you know sort of being not really saying eat less as Marion Nessel pointed out years ago. You know you don't ever say eat less of anything because that arouses everybody's nettle. Everyone gets upset with you if you say eat less of something. So they've tiptoed around that. But if you're going to talk about climate issues, you can't really avoid talking about the fact that we eat way too much meat, we eat way too much protein. Period. And that if you're going to have beef, it should certainly be pasture-raised. It should not be feedlot beef. And that's, of course, a hugely, hugely, hugely provocative issue for a very large industry in this country. So that's one of the things. And the others, I remember one of the ones in our original one was to eat less salt, which, of course, is generally a health recommendation and is not too much pushed back on, but we tied it generally ocean pollution but I can't remember exactly how we worked that one in. It was a little tougher, but we took all the dietary guidelines and tied them to environmental issues that were prominent at that time, and I have not looked at it recently, but I don't think I'd be embarrassed by any of it. But it certainly, there certainly are huge environmental issues. I mean, one of the things that I hope I'll just quickly bring up because I want to be sure we talk about it. In the governments just came out with this report of having climate friendly agriculture. I have not heard nearly enough discussion or comment about the fact that the Rodale Press report that came out showing that based on their own research that if everything was grown organically, if we or sustainably, you know, returning things to the soil, not using so much herbicide and pesticide, et cetera, we could actually, and if all animals were grazed, we could actually capture in every year all the CO2 that's put out, and perhaps more, so that we could actually begin to reverse global warming. They put that out. It's a very provocative idea, a very encouraging idea, but it's not being seriously discussed. it wasn't seriously discussed at all in that little government USDA thing about climate friendly
right. And yes,
agriculture.
That's you're referring.
And it's a huge challenge. Is that true? Is it true that would be all we would have to do? I mean, the thing is that people will say, oh, well, that's too. Africa's already doing that. I mean, the peasants in Africa have already discovered that if they go back to more traditional methods and use composting and stuff like that, which is not quite traditional, they will be able to produce more for less money, and they will have better soils. They've already discovered that in some of the poorest parts of the world. So it's not like it's a mystery and we're going to have to introduce this arcane new thing around the world. We just need to encourage it.
So I know you're referring to the launch of the Climate and Agriculture Alliance. I'm sure that's not quite the right term, but the USDA, along with other partners in the American government, have announced their formal partnership and participation in this alliance,
yes,
which includes...
it's called the Global Alliance for Climate Smart Agriculture.
Thank you.
Which got launched just...
this week, right?
Yesterday.
Right, and that there's been some questions about the potential for that because of who's participating, which includes a lot of industry members, but at the same time, many find it incredibly heartening that this is a very mainstream and critical discussion about the role of agriculture and climate and what can be done to improve it. And I think, you know, where that will go in terms of exploring some of the solutions that Rodale has proposed and that you're talking about in terms of agriculture being more than reducing the negative contributions of agriculture, that agriculture can really be part of reversing the impacts of putting carbon into the environment, is a very provocative and exciting idea. But before we wrap up, I want to get two more thoughts from you. So the first one is, you know, going back to the dietary guidelines and the role of the guidance that will be given to Americans about what they can buy and what they should be buying and thinking about both for their own health and potentially for the health of the overall food system. I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, versus major policy changes, what do you see as the role of the consumer in changing the food system and maybe even some, you know, sometimes people don't like the word consumer in talking about the importance of all that we all play in changing the food system. But I want to ask you that, you know, what is the role of the consumer and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the first role of the consumer is to get educated. I mean, to educate themselves, and it's so easy now with the web, it really is, but to educate themselves about where their food comes from and at what cost and to think about it. I mean, just to get themselves thinking about food in those terms. Not just that it's in the supermarket and it's cheap, but where it comes from and what the environmental costs of producing it are. And it's pretty easy to research. Excuse me. And there are a number of books out that relate to that. Mostly, if you really just look at the general dietary advice most nutritionists give, which is to eat more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, and less animal products, you'll be well on the way to reducing your environmental footprint. And if you then make sure that if you have an animal product, you know its origin and it doesn't come from the hideous animal food system that is producing most of our meat, which I must say, I say that without, it's just awful. I mean, if you read enough about the way hogs are raised or chickens are raised or cattle are raised, you wouldn't want to eat it. So try to find out where your meat comes from. Try to get to know a farmer. Try to eat from close to home. And pay attention and recognize, as Barbara Kingsolver said long ago, that if you, whatever great thing you do today, remember that it began with eating something that came out of soil. We need to remember that soil is at the root of the health of the entire planet. And the whole, entire economic system that we have is based on growing things, mining things, taking things from the earth, and using energy to convert them. And the energy ultimately comes either from fossil plants or from today's plants or from the air or from the sun. And that's what we have to keep in mind and not have this magic view that food just appears in the supermarket or on our tables.
Yeah, and that is one of the challenges with making change, because it's hard. It's more of an intellectual exercise for most people buying food to connect all the dots that you just talked about. And just to wrap up, I want to ask you both about the potential for people to do that just through thinking, essentially. Can they make better choices? And also, you know, what it's like for you at this point in your life to see so much attention and focus on issues that you were really one of the first to shed light on.
Well, it makes me not want to ever go out and give a speech, because I've already said it all, and I don't want to hear the sound of my own voice.
So thank you for coming on the air today. And that
it's like everyone's discovering these things, and I'm saying, right, that's fine, good. Yes, okay. I gave my last speech, and I wanted to give a cheerful speech. I wanted to talk about how local has become so popular, how people are paying attention, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, things kept hammering at me from my computer about things that were going on in the world, like we're going to have the highest bottled water will become the most popular beverage. I mean, the insanity of bottled water is an environmental issue. One after the other, these things came up. We're tearing up more prairie than we've torn up since the 1920s, and so on and on. So I'm tired of going out and bringing bad news. I've been doing this for 40 years.
Well, I thought you were going to say that you gave a happy speech and found that those were a lot less interesting to the audience, which might also be the case. So, so you'll continue to find things to make us all aware of, it sounds like, or help
well,
make us more aware.
Well, I have to keep looking at reality, and I mean, we had class last night, and we basically allowed the students to just go around and talk about, we were talking about food and people, but the climate march was so big in their lives, you know, it was such a heartening thing to see that many people, because they're experiencing this thing of taking my class in which they're learning all these horrors about the world, which people don't want to look at, and discovering that their friends don't want to talk about it, they don't want to hear about it, they don't want to believe it, they don't want to believe there's a problem. People are still in denial, and so the climate march was just to have all those people around them who believed as they did, you know, it was just wonderful.
And that, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's a great note to wrap the conversation up on. And that's where we started our show today, and we'll leave it there, and we'll see what momentum comes out of that march. And I want to thank you, Joan, and our other guests for participating today. That's going to bring us to the close of this episode of Eating Matters. And again, I'm Kim Kessler, and thank you for listening on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.